Jacob.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services, February 18th. And let's start with the public hearing. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4050A. Sandy, bring us up to date, and then it will be Doug Barber, Jake Gibbs, or who do you want to have come first of the panel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4050A comes to you from the House with, I believe it was a 57 ayes, 3 excused. It specifies that insurers may not issue or deliver a policy against risk of economic loss assumed under less than fully insured employee health benefit plan to employer groups with fewer than 51 employees, declares an emergency effective on passage. You should have A3s in your packet and the A4s in your packet. And the group will be speaking to the amendments as well.
Chair Bonus Anderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters in support of House Bill 4050. This bill passed unanimously on the House floor. And as Sandy said, this bill deals with businesses that are self-insured and have between or have more than 50 employees. I'll briefly set the stage and then let these businesses talk about why it's so important to them. Last session, House Bill 2240 was the ACA alignment bill. In that bill, it changed the definition of small group in Oregon. Currently, we define small group as groups of 2 to 50. The ACA defines small group as groups of 2 to 100. That change will be effective in 2016. The problem is elsewhere in Oregon law, where there is a prohibition on reinsurance for small groups. And it's that prohibition that is the problem. What this bill will do is allow these businesses that have been successfully reinsured for years to continue to buy the reinsurance, the stop-loss coverage that they need going forward. So as Sandy mentioned, there are two amendments. One would remove the prohibition altogether. The other would allow or would change it from 50 employees to 50 covered lives, and we can get into the details of those after these businesses speak. So I'll turn it over to Jake Gibbs.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Jake Gibbs. I'm with Lone Rock Timber out of Roseburg, Oregon. I'm part of the management team here, and I'm here to speak in support of HB 4050. Lone Rock has 93 employees currently. That the insurance that we enjoy covers 277 lives. We've been in business since 1950, excuse me, 60 years plus in business, 40 plus years of enjoying self-insurance. Over the course of the company's history, we've had as many as 350 employees and have, when we sold our manufacturing facilities is when we went down to the below the 100, but we still have maintained that self-insurance using the reinsurance caveat to enjoy that. I guess I'd just give you some background on the employees. I would say enjoy this service. They receive an incredible benefit package. In 2013, Lone Rock was named in the Business Magazine's top 100 companies. We were number 27 in the large business category. And why I bring that up is because that's employees do the rating on that. There's no other metric. It's a survey of the employees. And so we took that at the management level very seriously, that the employees were satisfied or if not exceptionally satisfied with how operations were going. We have a very strong kind of family culture. It's the employees think of this as ours, not their company, and the family, which is now in third generation of oversight, wishes to maintain that culture and continue it forward. This is one of those examples of how they want to maintain that. The benefits that we've seen from having self-insurance, kind of from the business side of it, is it's lower costs to our company with high value for our employees. Right now, because of the potential change to our ability to maintain this level of coverage. We've shopped around to see what it would cost us, and we're looking at a $100,000 price difference on an annual basis versus what we're currently able to enjoy. And I bring that up because in 2009, which was a record depressed year in the timber products industry, we were able to maintain all 93-plus of our employees during that tenure. We did lots of gymnastics to do that, but the savings that we've been able to incur or to save because of flexibilities of programs like being self-insured allowed us to use those reserves or those savings during a time like 2009. And while I never want to see that again, I would say that was how those dollars, when we see a saving, that's how we use those. So I guess in conclusion, I would just say that HB 4050 doesn't relieve us of any of our responsibilities. It just allows us to continue maintaining high caliber coverage for our employees, for myself and my family, and we'd like to continue to do that into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Apperson. I'm with Stagecraft Industries in Portland, Oregon. We're on Swan Island. We just celebrated our 53rd year as an employer in the state of Oregon, and we've been partially self-funded for over 20 years. Right now, I have 50 employees, so the amendments that we're going to talk about today are important to me. First, I'd like to say why we chose to be self-funded years ago to begin with, and it really has to do with the transparency that it allows us as the employer to see where our dollars are being spent, where our employees' dollars are being spent. We know how much the mix is between prescription drugs. We know if people are in network or out of network. We know if people are using the emergency room and urgent care as primary care physicians. And we can coach and counsel and provide our employees with the best opportunity to take advantage of what they're paying for and what we're paying for. That's important to us. It saved us money over the years. We've been able to maintain a very rich plan in the private sector. We pay for a huge portion of the employee and their dependent coverages. It's been a very good fit for Stagecraft. We want to be able to continue to be self-funded, and the bill as it currently sits would prevent us from doing that. Self-funding is not the right fit for everybody, but it's been a great fit for us. We've been doing it a long time. We'd like to be able to stay on board with that, and it's very important to my company. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel?
Yes,
Senator Cruz.
First off, Jake, you don't look right with a tie on, but that's a whole other issue. I'm kind of leaning towards the threes. And speak to the amendments.
Do you want me down there testifying?
No, you can do it from up here.
Do you want me to talk? What, since this is my bill? What do you want me to do?
That's
what.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, just somebody.
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Cruz, we would also agree that the three, we would support the dash threes, which are the eliminating the prohibition. We think businesses can make that decision for themselves about whether self-insurance is right for them. It's a financial decision. It's a business decision. The stop-loss carriers will look at them and decide if it's makes financial sense. We think businesses are sophisticated enough to make that decision. And as Tom said, it's not right for everybody. It's a small percentage. It might be 1 or 2% of the market. But for those who make the decision, it can be huge. And I think, Sean Garrett on the phone can talk about that experience in other states as well.
All right. Do you want to testify now, or do you want to?
I'm happy to do it however you prefer, Madam Chair. I'm happy to wait for other people and just do back cleanup if you'd like.
Yeah, I'll let's do that.
Sure.
Okay. No further questions. Cynthia, Cameron, and then we'll have Sean Garrett, who's on the phone.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Cynthia Cameron. I'm president of Benefit Specialists. We are a small boutique employee benefits consulting firm. And I happen to also be the broker for Tom Apperson at Stagecraft, who just recently testified. I just wanted to speak to the concept of the way the rules are currently written. For example, a group of 51 is considered a large group currently. That's measured by employees. And in the world of self-funding, it really doesn't really make a lot of sense to look at it that way from a risk standpoint. And the reason I mention this is because Tom Apperson's company, for example, Stagecraft, does make a large contribution for dependents. And so dependents are covered under their plan. So they have a total number of lives that far exceeds 51. I have another employer group that has decided to not cover dependents. So their number is just slightly over 51 as employees. So that second company is eligible for self-funding, and Tom's company will not be. And I think that's an important point, because the way that we measure this is really not accurate when it comes to a risk standpoint. The other point I want to mention is even if the prohibition's limited on self-funding and reinsurance in particular, it certainly wouldn't, in my opinion, change the reason that employers self-fund. All of the employers that we work with that self-fund primarily do it for the same reasons that Tom self-funds, which is that he likes having information to be able to make good decisions, and ultimately that's benefiting the employees. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions? Quiet group today.
Yes, I know.
All right.
Madam Chair, I just want to say, you know, we're talking about small businesses, and you know, as it was pointed out, these businesses and the employees, they're families. I mean, they truly are. Mm-hmm. It's everybody pulling together, and it's, you know, it's the beauty of small business. I'm a small business man myself, and that's the way I feel about my employees, and most small businesses do. So, you know, allowing them the flexibility to do what's in the best interest of their family, I think, is the appropriate thing to do.
Great. All right. Sean, take it away. Introduce yourself.
Okay.
Introduce
sure.
yourself. And
anything else?
Go.
And I was going to say, tell us where you're from.
Okay. Appreciate the time today. My name is Sean Garrett. I'm the COO of Plexus Healthcare Systems. We are a software development firm located in Ashland, Oregon. We are incorporated in 96, so we've been doing what we're doing for the last 17 years. And we serve health insurers, health insurance administrators, both domestically and internationally. So our software is to do the stuff, the back office administration of health insurance, both for fully insured administrators, as well as self-funded, self-insured administrators. And we have nearly 100 clients worldwide. In the United States, it's about 85% of our client base. Approximately 45% of those, so we're talking about 30-something clients, are third-party administrators, TPAs, for self-funded employer groups. And so that's why Doug was referring to our perspective on what other states are doing, because our clients are located all over the place, not just in Oregon. In fact, we have the majority of our clients are outside of Oregon. Plexus itself, so I'm going to speak briefly as a small employer in Oregon that is self-funded, like the other folks that have testified earlier, as well as our perspective of what other states are doing, as Doug mentioned. So I'll just speak to both briefly. Plexus, for the majority of our history, had, in fact, the first 14 out of 17 years, we were fully insured. We did not go self-funded, self-insured. We made the move a few years ago when we found that there really was no, it wasn't going to cost us more. In fact, we were going to see some level of savings. And more importantly, it's very important from our CEO standpoint to be able to have much more flexibility in how we regulate our plan, or design, I should say, our plan for employers. So we came from, like many groups, the fully insured world to the self-funded, self-insured. So we used our, what was a pretty rich plan to begin with in the fully insured side as the base or model in which to build our self-funded plan. So we took that as a base and then increased upon it. So we actually provided additional benefits that we historically did not or were not able to provide our employees. In the fully insured world, what you're often getting is a one-size-fits-all with some slight modifications, maybe a different copay, a different coinsurance here and there. So what you're getting is what the same guy down the street is purchasing as well. Self-funding allows us to keep the medical, dental, vision benefits that we always had and then build upon them. Our CEO is a huge proponent of wellness and preventative and alternative, so we actually added many benefits that we historically have not had, with chiropractic, massage, acupuncture, and more so, we've actually increased those benefits for the employees year over year since we've gone self-funded. So we've actually enriched our plan, and what we've seen is a small cost savings over fully insured when theoretically we should have seen significant cost increases. So that's important for us in attracting and retaining employees, is by being able to modify and tailor our benefit plan around the needs of our employees and their families, as has been discussed, you know, from the other groups testifying today. So for all of those reasons, we continue to be self-funded and continue to strongly desire to be self-funded as well. We are approximately 75 employees, so the prohibition historically has not been an issue for us, but going up to 100 employees definitely would. We can't guarantee while we are adding some jobs, won't get to the 100 employee minimum, and that's very worrisome for us. In regards to the industry we serve and the clients we serve, I polled many of the clients at one of our recent user group meetings about the impact to them, and based on what different states are now doing and some of the modifications they're putting in place. Oregon, you know, with what we're doing here with moving up to 100 employee minimum. Other states are taking a different tack. Some are raising the attachment point, which is the minimum dollars out of pocket must be spent by the employer before their stop loss policies can kick in. And other states are doing nothing. And the states that have done nothing, as far as no changes to current, however that those state regulations are specified, significant growth in self-funding. It's becoming more and more appealing to small groups. But I also looked at the perspective of some of these administrators and some of their clients directly that have far less than 50 employee lives. We have a client, third-party administrator client, that has a client, an employer client in Wyoming that has 46 total covered lives. That means they're probably right around 18 to 20 employee lives. They've been self-funded for over a decade. Another employer group has over a year's worth of financial reserves in the bank due to the cost savings. They've been self-funded for many years. So many groups that are less than 50 employees have been self-funded for years and years and years that are, A, financially stable, and B, continue to offer just as rich, if not richer, benefits than they might get on their commercial market, fully insured market. So we see that Oregon can benefit as well with the stated proposed amendments by going even below the 50 employee limit that it stands today. But we only see that going in reverse if the current legislation stands and it moves to 100 employees come 2015. So that's what I wanted to kind of provide for you today, based on not just us as an employer that is self-funded, that's under 100 employees, but also what we're seeing in other states based on the clients that we have and who they serve and how beneficial it has been to even smaller employee groups, employee-based groups.
Questions for Mr. Garrett? Great. Thank you so much for calling in. I would like to just bring Laura Kelly up and address a little bit about the prohibition or removing the prohibition, as well as covered lives and uncovered lives, and are there many businesses that are self-insured that are less than 50?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner, and I'll do my best to run through all of those points, and if I miss anything, just stop me and ask questions along the way. So I should first state that we don't have a position on the bill or the amendments. We have been working with the interested parties on this and talking for quite some time. So I should first mention that self-insured employers, so the current employers that choose to self-insure, they're not regulated by us, so we don't collect data on the number of employers that currently self-insure. So we can't say for sure how many currently do or if there were changes to the law, how that might change, if there might be more that decide to make that decision. Our understanding of the reason why the ban exists today was back in the early 90s when the small group market was converted to a guaranteed issue market. There was some concern about whether you might actually have the good risks leave the pool and you would be left with higher rates and, you know, basically you'd leave all the poor risks in the insurance pool. So that was the original intent. It's been a guaranteed issue for market for some time, so the underwriting hasn't been a factor in the small group market. You know, that being said, we're not really sure that there are a tremendous number of employers that self-insure that are in the smaller size range. It's still a pretty important financial decision for a small employer to make. Even if they are able to buy stop loss, they have to be sure that they can pay up to the attachment point, which I think the previous gentleman mentioned, that's the point at which the stop loss actually kicks in. And so we also have some minimum limits in statute about what that level is. So in terms of removing the ban altogether, again, we don't have a position on that, but I just want to reiterate that if it's a self-insured plan, it doesn't fall under our regulatory authority. So we don't regulate the rates for stop loss. They're filed with us, but we don't have the same rigor of the rate review process. But it, you know, there is added flexibility there, and so typically employers are going to be working with a broker and will, you know, work on negotiating those terms. But just wanted to be clear about what the extent of our authority is there. That also does mean that, as some of the previous folks have testified, we also don't impose certain limitations on the benefit designs. So, you know, I think that has some pluses and minuses. I think it gives businesses some control over the benefit designs, but it means that we're not reviewing their plans in advance and kind of ensuring that they meet certain requirements. But self-insured plans would fall under ERISA, so they'd be under federal regulation, just not under state. So hopefully I've answered most of your questions, but if there's anything else I've missed, I'm happy to answer them.
Well, I'm going to have Senator Steiner Hayward do cleanup, but are there any questions for...
Yes, Madam Chair, and so essentially what we're doing is we're keeping the status quo here. We're not expanding the number of companies that can pursue self-insurance, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I believe that the engrossed version of the bill maintains the status quo. The proposed amendments would, I think one would actually expand slightly the number of employers that could be eligible to could be eligible to buy reinsurance. They can still self-insure without it. And then I think the dash four is remove the ban altogether. So anyone, any business size could self-insure. But the engrossed version, as I understand it, preserves the status quo.
Thank you.
Great. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Do you want me to stay up here or go down there?
Your preference. Doesn't matter.
I'll just stay here if that's all right with you, Madam Chair. I think the previous witnesses have done a great job of explaining the rationale for this. I first learned of this, oh gosh, last summer, I guess, because there are several businesses in my district that self-insure and have done a lot of the same things that our witnesses have done, which is work closely with their employees to design a benefit plan that works for them and to help them improve their health. To my mind, this is essentially a free market issue. And it's about allowing small businesses to make the decisions about how to run their business that makes the most sense for them and their employees, encouraging them to work closely with their employees to design health packages that are focused on health, that are focused on wellness, which is what I think most of them do. And certainly our witnesses testified to this effect. And so personally, my preference is, I think it's the A3s that remove the prohibition altogether, removes lines 22 through 24 of the A engrossed version on page 1. And my preference, Madam Chair, would be to move the A3s and leave this to the market to figure out. If it's really only 1 to 2%, as Mr. Barber testified, that are doing this currently, I really doubt that we would see that increase precipitously were we to remove the prohibition. And I'm not sure it's the state's place to be regulating what should be a free market decision on this. I think that if the stop loss, if the underwriters who write these policies think it's too big a risk, they'll price them in a way that small business will decide it's cost prohibitive to do it. And if they decide that the company they're working with can manage it, then they'll write a policy that's affordable to the business, and they'll figure out whether they can make it work or not. I also think that ultimately, if we discover that this turns out to be a problem, either in terms of lots of companies bailing out of the market, the concern that Ms. Calley brought up about the healthier companies bailing out, or if we discover that employers aren't maintaining sufficient reserves, we can deal with it from that perspective in terms of regulating what kinds of reserves they need to keep in some way. But I don't think that this is the right way to deal with that, this market. I think we need to open it up and let companies make this decision for themselves. Small business people are entrepreneurial, and they should be able to figure out how to make this work.
Great.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it is going to be a small universe. I'm a small business, and there's no way in the world we would ever be self-insured. We just can't do the capitalization to get there. It's just not in our business plan. But this is for a business. This is part of the business plan. And, you know, we're supposed to be pro-business. This is a pro-business move.
Okay, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think I'm okay with the amendment, but I did want to ask a clarifying question. If an employee of one of these self-insured plans has difficulty getting a claim paid, what recourse would they have compared to an insured plan?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, so because a self-insured plan would not be under our regulatory authority, we couldn't necessarily compel an employer to pay a claim the same way that we can work with an insurer if we find that they've violated the insurance code. That being said, we actually get calls quite often from employees who have self-insured plans, and we still work with their administrator, try to help them get a good result. I think we just don't have the same level of authority that we would with a fully insured plan, but we do try to assist through our consumer advocacy to help get that figured out. But I think that the typical avenue is that you'd have an employer or employee would work with their employer. That might send them to the TPA to kind of discuss coverage issues or how the claim was administered, and it would go from there. But we routinely get questions about things that are kind of outside our scope, but we try to assist consumers as much as we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would certainly support the end of the prohibition on this. My question really is, would that amendment jeopardize the bill in the House at all? Now, were there any commitments made?
Madam Chair, it has been my understanding that if we do the threes, that the chair of the House Health Committee will concur with the amendment and repass the bill.
And I have been told the same thing.
Great. Thank you.
And I'm perfectly happy to have a conversation. This happens to be a Senate District 17 bill. My co-chief on this bill is Representative Harker from District 34. The chair of House Health happens to be my other representative, so I'm happy to go back and double-check with him. But my sense has been that he really doesn't have a problem with this.
And I think enough of us have been told that, and I think we're good. So.
Okay. So any other discussion? I would like to at least go into work session to adopt the amendment, and then we can send it down to legislative fiscal to get the work. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this bill? All right. I gave you the opportunity. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4050A and open a work session on House Bill 4050A.
Madam Chair, I move the -A3 amendment to House Bill 4050A.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A3s into Senate Bill 4050, and that actually removes the prohibition altogether, correct? Yes. All right. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close the work session on House Bill 4050A and close the public hearing on House Bill. Oh, no. I'll just close everything. We're done. We're done. All right. Colleagues, we now have a couple of informational hearings, and the first one, yes?
No, I just want to.
Okay.
Shauna, are you still on the phone?
I am.
All right. Well, you can certainly stay for our informational hearings, but you're welcome to sign off. All right.
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you folks today. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'd like to open an informational hearing on the health systems transformation. We have Mary Kay Owens, Executive Director of the Institute for Healthcare Innovation Strategies, and she's primary author of this study, The Healthcare Imperative, Lowering Costs and Improving Outcomes in the Institute of Medicine. And this is something that was brought to my attention by Nicole Palmatier, and I am very grateful that she has agreed to come all the way to Oregon from Washington, D.C., correct?
It's warmer here.
Thank
Please
you.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mary Kay Owens, Executive Director of the Institute for Healthcare Innovation Strategies. I don't know if I could request that you dim the lights just a little. Perfect. That way you'll be able to see the colors and the charts that my staff spent so much time doing. So today I wanted to have the opportunity to present to you some ideas about what's going on in other states that we've been working with in the areas of healthcare transformation, and to talk about some analytical methodology that exists to help you target and identify the right patients. So I'm a pharmacist by training, formerly with the Medicaid Program Integrity as a certified investigator. I also was the director of the Florida Medicaid Drug Utilization Review Program for many years, and I've spent the last 20, 25 years in Medicaid policy and analytics. So we've worked with a number of states in a lot of different areas and looking at care coordination models, how do you adopt utilization management strategies within an integrated care model, and how do you look at integrating medical home with behavioral and physical health. So just want to give you those background. Identifying the targets, what we want to do is actually focus on the right patients, because not every patient needs the same level of care coordination in a health plan. And so the patients that we're looking for are those that have uncoordinated care, lack of appropriate medication use, unmet treatment goals, and a lot of avoidable costs. So I'm going to give you a few examples from all the states that we've done analytics. We've now done an extensive analysis of 9 states over multiple years of data, and I'll talk about some published articles in just a minute. So in general, these are the things that we find, and you could well imagine we have a lot of patients who have no treatment at all, yet they're incurring hundreds of millions of dollars annually in inpatient hospitalization visits and physician office visits for chronic conditions and mental health conditions. We have very low drug adherence rates and persistency rates. Approximately 50% of the time, patients are not taking their chronic health medications. We have a lot of clinical goals that are unmet. People are not at their appropriate hemoglobin A1Cs for diabetes or blood pressure. We have a lot of uncoordinated care where we have patients seeing multiple providers and multiple prescribers. We have patients seeing 30, 40, 50 different treating physicians, you know, over the course of a year period of time. We have a lot of avoidable ED and hospital visits and readmissions. And then, of course, substance abuse is a very real problem, and it's often correlated with mental health issues as well. So some of the findings that I wanted to share with you are from the detailed analysis that we've done in a number of states. You can see here that Alabama, we identified between $360 and $390 million in savings that is available to them. Using their claims data, we take the claims data, we run it through a series of algorithms, and I'll explain those in just a minute. But these are the areas that we've identified savings for them that they're actually going to use in their care coordination model rollout that they're in the process of doing right now, which is similar to the North Carolina and the Oregon plan. So these are just an outline of the different areas that we looked at. We looked at ER and hospital visits with narcotic abuse, pharmacy efficiency areas, increasing medication adherence, and you can see it's a significant amount of money. In New Jersey, we identified over $140 million, looking at a number of these issues, reducible and avoidable mental health and substance abuse visits was a significant area. In Virginia, $187 million in looking at very similar things, duplication of medications that were inappropriate in those patients. Ohio, about $655 million in savings. So you can see that there are common themes here. Florida, $365 million. And so the idea of how do you identify actually where the savings in the program is, not just where do you reduce the rate of growth. Reducing rate of growth and finding savings are two completely different things. So I'm going to talk about the intelligent claims analysis model that we actually spent 15 years developing. It is a clinically and statistically validated set of algorithms that the claims data passes through, and it identifies the patterns and indicators that we know are indicative of uncoordinated and inappropriate care. And there are hundreds of algorithms that are statistically set with thresholds, but in general, what we're looking at is uncoordinated care, a lot of different physicians touching a patient, prescribing medications for them, ordering labs, a lot of it duplicative, a lot of it what we call clinical nonsense. It doesn't even fit with some of the diagnosis that we see for those patients. Accessing the ER for primary care, as you know, that's a major problem across the board. Avoidable visits, duplicative services. We actually can map all the duplicative services that a patient has within a 12 to 24 month period of time and map that specifically to the individual providers that ordered those tests and prescribed those drugs. Identifying random drug switching, which is a very complex thing to do in an algorithm because there are hundreds of thousands of drug codes that have to be coded into the algorithm. But in doing that, it gives us a lot of indicators about how well their care is being coordinated or not coordinated. And then a court of inappropriate use of services. So you might say, well, what does an uncoordinated care patient look like? So I just randomly pulled a patient here from one of the states. And you can see this is a 46-year-old female. She has cardiac problems. She has COPD. She has depression. She had a total of 185 prescriptions within a 12-month period of time, about $8,000 in drugs. She had 54 different treating physicians touching her, 34 of them prescribing meds, and 21 different pharmacies that she was accessing to receive her medications. Now, there is some narcotic-seeking behavior, obviously, here. You see that she has 16 different prescribers from 10 different pharmacies, but that's not necessarily her entire problem. 395 medical events within the calendar year. The last time I checked, there were 365 days in a year. So this is a full-time patient. Now, this is what some people would say is an overutilizer patient, right, in terms of services. But when you look at her cost, she really would not be considered to be a high-cost patient. A $36,000 a year patient would be under the radar screen. It would not be a person that would be in the top tier. So sometimes patients are very expensive. Sometimes they're not. But the point is identifying the patterns of uncoordinated care. So this patient actually should have cost approximately $5,000 to $6,000 to appropriately treat for the conditions that she has. So you can see that in just this one patient, there's about a $30,000 savings that's realizable. Now, our study on our 5-year worth of analysis on these states looked at the Institute of Medicine actually had us spend 2 years going through internal and external peer review because they were very interested in this innovative methodology for how do you very much target the right group of patients. And they wanted to know how much money in the healthcare system is being wasted right now. And so we took the national healthcare expenditure data for them, and we ran that against all of the analytics that we had already done in those five states. And this was published, and I have it as background materials for you if you'd like to access the publication. But you can see that it's about $240 billion a year that are being spent on just what are uncoordinated care and unnecessary services. So this is very significant. When you talk about healthcare transformation, if you don't deal with these issues, we're not going to be very successful. So I'll give you some comparisons from different states. This has actually been uncanny in terms of any state that I were to put the data up here for you, the numbers would be very similar. An uncoordinated care patient on average costs about $15,000 a year to care for, and that's, you know, across the board average for the whole population. Some of them are $100,000, $30,000 a year patients. the coordinated care, I will say the better coordinated. There's no 100% well-coordinated patient really that exists, but if we compare to people that are not in the extreme outlier group, it's about $3,000 a year. And so you can see that it's about five times the cost, and this is what we published in the article. Anywhere from five to seven times the cost is what we found in every analysis in Medicaid plans and with state Medicaid fee-for-service plans that we've done this analysis. The important part is to see that uncoordinated care impacts every single sector. It impacts labs, outpatient cost, ER, physician, pharmacy, hospital, and so on average, we know that it's about five times the cost.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes.
So you're, just to be clear, you're talking about the difference between a fee-for-service system and a capitated system.
No. This is all fee-for-service data that I'm showing you in these slides that I have here. I have managed care data, but what I'm showing you is fee-for-service data. But when we do the analysis in the managed care plans, we find exactly the same thing.
That's interesting. Okay.
What we would see is that about 10% of patients would be identified using the algorithms as being the most extreme uncoordinated care patients. That doesn't mean that we've identified every patient that has uncoordinated care. What we're looking for is the top tier of patients so that you can say, well, where's the group that we should focus on first? So those 10% of patients in any of these plans represent almost half of all the prescription costs that were spent for the plan for the year. Okay, that's very significant. About 32% of medical costs and over a third of all the drug and medical costs combined. This actually happens to be Ohio state data that we did a couple years ago. And so what we know from all of the analytics and all of the match comparisons that we've done looking at patients, at least 35% of their cost is avoidable because it is duplicative and inappropriate care. Okay.
Could I make a comment?
Yes, please. Please.
Thank you. I think, you know, Ms. Owens, I appreciate your focus on cost. I think it's also important to focus on the fact that it's actually better health care and that people are more likely to be healthy.
Yes, I would agree.
The first patient you described, I mean, she was a professional patient. Now, she had some other issues, some other mental health issues and potentially addiction issues need to be dealt with. But there are people who don't want to be in doctor's offices all the time, and yet, because of the reasons that Ms. Owens is describing, are.
Right.
And that means they're not working, they're not on their jobs, they're not with their kids, they're not doing the things that they need to do to stay healthy, they're not actually able to take proactive steps to improve their health, and they're often ending up with medication interactions that are causing adverse effects,
worse
which require to take more medications, which cause more adverse effects. So we actually can end up with healthier people at a lower cost.
Yes.
More money spent on healthcare is generally not a good thing.
Right.
Not just not usually, not generally.
That's right.
So I think this work is very important, not just from the cost.
And what I would speak to is it's not about the cost of the patients. It's about, and all of our work is focused on, what should that patient have cost if they were appropriately treated for the conditions that they have.
Right.
If that's $100,000, then fine, let it be $100,000. If it should be $5,000, then it should be $5,000. So it's not about rationing care. It's not about withholding services. It's about allocating the resources to the patients who need it the most in terms of quality and cost. So
exactly.
So one of the things that I want to talk about today is what is very different. There's a widespread common focus in the healthcare world right now on what they call the 80-20 rule or the 90-10 rule. Who are the people in your plan that cost you all the money? And it's usually a small percentage of people. But the point I want to make to you today is that that is not at all the analytics that we're doing. We are focused on a patient, whether they are a $5,000 a year patient or whether they're a $100,000 a year patient. And it's not always about high cost and high utilization. And so the point of this slide right here is to show you that we broke down the patients on their average annual medical and drug cost, and we put them in these buckets that we call them across these cost groups. And what you can see is that the uncoordinated care patients fall from the lowest cost all the way to those that are more than $100,000 a year. So it is not about what the cost of the patient is. It's about what should that patient have appropriately cost us for the care that they needed and the care that they deserve. And so in doing this, if you only focus on these last two bars over here, which are you know, what most people would consider to be your high-cost, high-utilizer bars, if you can't differentiate the people in the blue from the people in the red, then you are consuming all your resources basically in a shotgun method of not knowing whether you're hitting the right patients or not with some intensive intervention. And what we know is that about half the time, these patients that are high-cost, high-utilizers really are people who need those services because they are very sick, they have very complex comorbid conditions, and that's not the group of people that we want to focus our resources on if we're trying to get a return on investment and trying to get to the target group of patients who really do have cost and quality improvement that can be realized. So it's all about finding the actionable patients. So it's not about who cost you money in the system. It's about where is the cost savings.
I will just say on a very personal note, if I might, I'm a high-cost patient. I'm a very high-cost patient because I use a very expensive medication for my MS. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody considers me a problem patient in the system because I see two doctors.
Right.
I take my medications as prescribed.
Right.
And I'm being a pretty productive member of society,
so,
I think.
So, you know, you would fall up here in the blue portion of this higher cost group, but you would be in the blue portion of the bar, and we wouldn't be at all concerned about you.
Right.
Okay. So I'll move on here. So some additional analysis that we've done is, and because I'm a pharmacist, I'm very interested in what is the role that appropriate medication serves in getting us better health care, better quality of care, but also getting us to an appropriate cost. So what we did was take all of the patients who were coordinated and adherent on their medications. We used the common HEDIS measure of 80% or more adherent. And we put those people in the blue sections of the bar here. These happen to all be schizophrenia patients. And then we compared them to the uncoordinated care, non-adherent patients who were not taking their antipsychotic medication, and they were drug switching. And when we say drug switching, those are patients that are changing drugs every single month, for example, to treat their schizophrenia because they are accessing a different clinic or a different provider every month. And one doctor is not talking to another doctor. And then they're having inpatient visits. And so what you see here in the first bar is the average hospital or inpatient costs that were all coded for schizophrenia. So these are not, you know, they had their gallbladder out and they got admitted for that. These are specifically their schizophrenia inpatient hospital costs. And you see the magnitude of the difference here, $20,000 a year versus roughly $2,000. So that represents $18,000 per person in avoidable inpatient visits when you look at who's compliant on their medications, who's persistent and stable on the same medication every month, and their care being well coordinated. If you move to look the second bar, these are all of their schizophrenia costs. So that would be inpatient, outpatient, labs, whatever the other costs were that were treating their schizophrenia. And you can see that difference is very similar. But what's interesting to me is that where were all of their schizophrenia costs? They were all in inpatient visits. $20,000 of the $23,000 is inpatient schizophrenia visits. So they really don't have that many outpatient visits. It's all inpatient visits that's driving the cost variance here. And so then when you look at their average mental health total cost, you can see it was about $32,000 a year versus $6,000 a year. Now, if I said what was their total cost of care because they have diabetes, they have other problems, it's around $50,000 a year. But you're still looking at anywhere between $20,000 and $30,000 potential cost savings on just this group of patients. This was about 1,000 patients in this comparison that we're looking at right here. So you multiply those numbers out, that's a lot of money in savings in a very small number of people, and we know exactly who those people would be, and we know exactly what the intervention should be that would get us that savings. So the purpose of the innovative analysis utility is to identify the cost-saving targets and the quality improvements by doing the analysis of the baseline claims and counter data and then doing quarterly monitoring. Now, the population baseline, I want to point this out, should not include these uncoordinated care patients. And one of the things I want to point out to you in your global budgeting and in your calculations of PMPM, as everyone is doing, is that they leave these uncoordinated care patients with all of their inappropriate and inflated cost in the baseline. When you do that, now you are artificially setting the rate higher for the whole population because you've not separated out these people that have inappropriate costs, right? So when you're trying to measure changes and you're only measuring changes in the baseline of the population and you're not measuring changes in a specific targeted interventional group, then you get a very different picture of what's going on. And so if you really want to derive cost savings rather than just reductions in escalation of the trends and costs, you have to focus on these people as a separate, a subset of the population. And so your baselines should really be calculated separately. So you can use this to determine your patterns of care, your avoidable cost, and making budget-driven decisions as a legislative group. It's an ongoing tool so that you could actually compare one CCO to another, and you would say to that CCO, okay, you know, it's not just about here's your bucket of money that you're going to be given to take care of these patients. If you're already giving them way too much money, perhaps, and you're not taking out these uncoordinated care costs, in my opinion, what would be better suited for everyone is to create a separate risk pool for them and to say, okay, now we're going to measure, here's your targeted group of patients. Show me what you can do in 2 years, 3 years to change that baseline, not just the whole baseline of your population, because then what you'll see is cost savings, not reductions in the rate of growth. Does that make sense?
It does. And, of course, I wish all the CCO people were here to hear this, because this has been our focus with CCOs. They have their global budget, and they may be targeting, just as you had pointed out, just those high utilizers, those high users, mm-hmm. and not looking at the broad spectrum. Right. But you said that they would need to have claims database.
Mm-hmm. So all the normal data that they have, they all have claims data. They're paying bills, so they have a claim for every. They have every claim. So also should the Oregon Health Authority also have all access to all the claims data. My advice would be an independent analysis to actually set the baseline for every CCO, because their risk stratification, their population is different, right? So one CCO might have a small number of uncoordinated care patients, another one might have a large number, but they shouldn't all be held to the same standard. They should set their baseline markers and their performance measures so that you are consistently performing better and better and better every year on that targeted group of patients. And you basically, by doing quarterly uploaded the data, you re-identify and re-risk stratify every patient so that there's always a list of people that are at the top who are your interventional target group. That way you make significant progress in the right subset of the population that you're trying to impact cost.
Great.
So this can also be applied to Medicaid, state employees, to Medicare dual programs. It helps you measure how well your intervention strategy is. You know, if your medical homes are really working or are they not working, do you need different kinds of interventional strategies? So it really serves as a tool to measure and evaluate a lot of different things. So just the next steps in terms of what I just covered is an independent and ongoing evaluation of the CCOs to set the standard reporting, to look at measures and utilization changes, to manage the targeted group of patients, and to use these analytics to continue to modify and create a, you know, none of us are saying we can get from 0 to 100 in 1 year or even in 2 years, but you certainly can even quarterly see significant changes in the utilization and cost of these patients as you set these targets. So I think it's really important to think about that.
When you say independent ongoing mm-hmm. evaluations, you know, we're hurting here because we didn't have independent mm-hmm. ongoing evaluation on some of our IT projects. But what is the ballpark figure for a state like Oregon to have independent ongoing evaluations of our CCOs?
Well, there's the way we do it, there's two different ways. If all the data was in one data set and you wanted to actually set different targets for each CCO, it would be like, and I think you have, 10, 15 of those organizations?
15?
Yeah. So there's a little bit more cost in doing that, because that's kind of like me doing 15 states at one time, because mm-hmm. for one thing, you don't want to hold everyone to the same measures, and you want to evaluate the baseline in that subset of the population that is for that region and that CCO. off the in doing like a standard fee for service for like a 2 million or 3 million Medicaid population like we just did for Alabama. I mean, it's public record that our costs for doing that were around $150,000, so it's very cheap in terms of finding hundreds of, you know, and so we identified $360 million worth of service, you know, duplicative and inappropriate services. So it's very cost effective to do this. This is not millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Thank you.
So that kind of brings me to the end. These were some of the stakeholders and partners that we often encourage both plans and state organizations to work with. I'll mention one down here, which is AIM. I serve on the National Alliance for Integrated Medication Management, and one of their goals is to bring clinical pharmacy services into a CCO or an ACO model and to actually work with the care coordination of the providers within that network to coordinate and manage their appropriate medication use. And that can be very beneficial. They have grants available to work with states to do that. So I just throw that out to you to think about. But that's really conclusion. Took up, I think, all of my time, but I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
No, this has been very, very, very much informational. This is the kind of information we need when we go forward with healthcare reform. Any comments? Thank you, Ms. Owens, so much for coming and presenting this valuable. Yes, Senator
Cruz. It'd be nice if we could get a hard copy of that presentation.
There it is. Thank you so much for your time.
I find it difficult to go completely paperless.
I'd be happy to follow up individually or with your staff as well. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. I'd like to close the and have a safe trip back.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like to close the public informational meeting on health system transformation and open an informational meeting on progress report on the long-term care systems plan. Mike McCormick, please. And Senator Cruz and I serve along with Representative Nathanson, and I forget who the other member is this work group.
Madam Chair, it's Representative Davis.
Yes.
And Representative Nathanson from the House side. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the Director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. To refresh everyone's memory, Senate Bill 21 was passed in the 2013 legislative session. It requires the department to convene a planning group to look at ways to improve and strengthen Oregon's publicly funded long-term care system. The whole premise behind this bill has been Oregon has been a leader in long-term care in the nation, and it's about staying out ahead in this regard as we're preparing our system for the baby boomers, which are going to be growing our system. It's about being proactive, staying ahead of that growth. I've said this to many people, and I'll say it again, there is no crisis in growth in long-term care in our system. It's been very, flat for the most part. The bill is really just trying to be proactive and stay ahead of what's going to be coming to Oregon. So Senate Bill 21 consists of 19 members, 4 legislators. We have representatives from our provider organizations, and we have lots of providers from our consumer and advocacy organizations. Our work to date, we had our first meeting in October, which was pretty much foundational in nature. We gave everyone a background of all of the work that has been done to date, the bill itself, et cetera. We had 3 more meetings in November, December, and January. We created 2 subcommittees initially. The very strong consensus amongst the members was that we needed really good data on the causes of entry into publicly funded long-term care. All of the cost drivers, what is going on with that. So we formed a data and research subcommittee, which consists of several members, many of whom are experts in this area. The sample size for this exercise is 513 individuals who presented to one of our public offices and requested long-term care services, received an assessment, and ultimately received a determination of their service priority level. We didn't limit the population to individuals who ultimately access publicly funded long-term care, because we also wanted to see, of those who didn't, why they didn't. Was it cost? Was it they didn't like their choice of providers, et cetera? So the data is going to be very rich. We're going to be able to report out information on age, race, ethnicity, the setting in which they reside, the types of entry. Is it caused by an acute event? Is it caused by a social event, loss of housing, loss of family supports, all of that? It's going to be very telling for this work. And, you know, I'm very excited about the ultimate report that will come out of this. So as of today, we have completed our first pass on the samples. We're going to be sharing that with the work committee, the subcommittee members soon. Our plan is to present the findings from that work at the March meeting. The next subgroup that was formed was the assessment subgroup. So in the 2013 session, the department received funding to begin planning for a new case management system that would ultimately be used across the agency. So what we needed to know up front was, what is going to be the output of our assessment system? Our data showed that we have a 13-level assessment system resulting in service priority level determinations. We found that 90% of the people are within four of those levels. So we asked the question, you know, is this a good system if 90% of the people fall into those four categories? And so this assessment subcommittee is tackling that and is going to be offering recommendations on what the output of an assessment should be. There are also tackling the things that we should be capturing in our assessments that we're not doing currently. And ultimately, they're hoping that the assessment output is going to be able to identify people at risk, and potentially where a strategy could be employed, where you're getting to people earlier and, you know, investing a dollar today, you know, to save $10 tomorrow. That's the whole concept behind the improved assessment system. The next subcommittee that was formed was caregivers. This is a national issue. This is not an Oregon-specific issue. We have issues about the quality of our workforce. Are they properly trained? Are they ready to take on increasingly complex work? The issues of the family caregivers who provide, I forget the exact statistics, but it's over 90% of the long-term care in our nation. What should we be doing to support the family caregivers in our nation? What are the training requirements? How do we prepare to ensure that we're going to have an adequate workforce in Oregon, not only to support people in their own homes, but to support people in nursing facilities and, you know, assisted living facilities, et cetera. So that group just got underway, and we're not expected for recommendations or a report out to occur until August. The last subcommittee that has been formed to date is the service equity subcommittee, and this is a very high priority for both me personally and for the agency as a whole. Service equity is really about, it's not about ensuring equal access to services, it's around getting equal outcomes for people. So what are the barriers that are keeping people of different races and ethnicities, different languages, different cultures, et cetera, having equal outcomes with other populations? So this group is tackling all of the data. We have some very rich data on what's going on in our long-term care system. They're going to drill down and figure out kind of... They're going to enhance the quality of that data through, you know, stakeholder engagement, you know, to validate the data and determine what's going on. And ultimately, the work that should come out of that is our recommendations that the agency should employ in order to improve service equity across all of our populations in Oregon. So we did not hold a steering committee meeting in February because we knew that we would be presenting to this committee and also to the House Human Services Committee. We're going to resume our work in March. We're going to have two major report outs, as I mentioned. Our plan is that, and, you know, as Senator Montesanderson and Senator Cruz know, we have a very ambitious agenda, a lot of work to get through in this group. Our hope is to complete as much as possible by August and then to take those recommendations out on the road and go into different communities, present the recommendations and get feedback on our work, and ultimately to come back with a plan, review the feedback of those community meetings to the full Senate Bill 21 group in December, and then that will launch us into our presentation or proposal to the legislature in February of 2015. So I thank you for the opportunity to provide this update, and I'm available for questions.
Yes, Senator.
And then just a couple comments. Number one, Senator Mona Sanderson and I purposely decided not to be on the subgroups so that they can do the work, because ultimately it comes back to us anyway, and we thought that was appropriate because we will get the updates. But I would also suggest that we're going to expect a fair amount of detail in September ledge days. So December is a little late to really be starting a lot of the legislative actions. So
I don't know if you'll
we'll at least have an idea at that point in time of where. Well, we'll have an idea, but
yes,
we'll need it presented to
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. We will definitely have excellent progress by that time.
Yeah, I think it's important to have progress, not say a 10-minute presentation to the committee, but then November too, because if there's legislation, of course, it may come through the governor's.
It could, but it
could come to us because our drop-dead date is for bills would be...
Well, no, for the long session, it's...
We could be any time.
Yeah.
But if it's pre-session filed,
I
don't know if we'd be interested in pre-session filing anything.
I think by then we'll have conceptual of what legislative action will need to be taken, what you can do internally, so...
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? Thanks, Mike, Mr. McCormick, so much for coming and giving us the update. And if there's no, and I'll close the informational hearing on long-term care systems plan. And colleagues, on Thursday, we're going to have House Bill 4013, which is the transmit e-prescriptions. It's a work session. I forget which amendment.
There's the... The step therapy amendment that's still
in.
Haven't gotten, they're still navigating.
Still working.
Yes.
House Bill 4074A, that waives the requirements for imaging. And that's
with the dash sixes.
And the dash six, I think there's pretty much consensus with the dash sixes.
Yeah.
And then House Bill 4028A is a new one that's a on the lottery.
Gambling.
So we're going to go buy tickets?
Okay. With that, we're adjourned. With that, we're adjourned.